Coming to the last part of this chapter called Unsupported and Unsupportive Consciousness. Lastly, in this chapter, we will look at some related passages from the Northern Buddhist tradition. Here is a section of the Platform Sutra, otherwise known as the Sutra of Huineng. At this point in the story, Huineng is a teenage layman working as a lowly seller of firewood, an only child trying to support his widowed mother. And this is a quote from this sutra. I'll read more from shortly. Once a customer bought firewood and ordered it delivered to his shop. When the delivery had been made and Huineng had received the money, he went outside the gate where he noticed a customer reciting a sutra. Upon hearing the words of this sutra, quote, one should produce the thought that is nowhere supported. Huineng's mind immediately became open to enlightenment. The word thought there can be interpreted as a concept or a mental formation. One should produce the thought that is nowhere supported. So I felt this is very closely related to the theme of this chapter. The passage he describes as having heard actually comes from the Vajra, the Diamond Sutra, one of the most influential wisdom teachings of the Northern School. And this is from chapter 10 of the Vajra Sutra, the adornment of pure lands. Therefore, Subhuti, the Bodhisattva, Mahasattva, should produce a pure heart. They should realize and develop the heart which does not dwell in forms, sounds, smells, tastes, tangible objects, or dharmas. They should realize and develop the heart which dwells nowhere. This insight into, quote, the heart which dwells nowhere, or, quote, the mind which rests on nothing, unquote, had a very powerful effect on the young man. He immediately resolved to leave the home life and to study the way with the fifth patriarch, Great Master Hung Chen at Tung Chan Monastery. Fortunately, his enthusiasm impressed other townspeople, and a man made a large offering of silver to Huineng so that his mother would be provided for while the lad went in search of spiritual riches. Once he had arrived at the monastery, because he was both young and illiterate, as well as spiritually precocious, the patriarch, the fifth patriarch, gave him the job of cutting wood and pounding rice in the kitchen. After some time, the fifth patriarch announced that he would soon pass on the patriarchy, the leadership of the Chan community, and in order to select an appropriate successor, he invited everyone to write a, quote, gatha without marks, unquote, a verse expressing their understanding of the essence of the Buddha's wisdom. So I thought I would read those passages that come from the sutra itself. This is one of my favorite Dharma books. I confess to preference. This is a unique presence in the Buddhist canon. It's the only sutra in the Chinese canon that comes from after the Buddha's time. It's accepted as a sutra in the Tripitaka. It's from the Tang Dynasty, so about the 7th century, about 1400 years ago. This takes up the story from when Huineng has been offered the support of this rich layman in his hometown to help support his mother, and then his initiative to go off to seek realization with the fifth patriarch, the great wisdom teacher of his time. After hearing this, and because of a karmic connection from the past, I was given 10 ounces of silver by another customer so I could provide my elderly mother with food and clothing. He told me to go right to Huang Mei and bow to the fifth patriarch. After making the necessary arrangements for my mother's welfare, I left right away and arrived in Huang Mei in about 30 days. There I bowed to the fifth patriarch, who asked me, where are you from? What do you seek? I replied, your disciple is a commoner from Jin province in Lingnan. I come from afar to bow to you and seek only to be a Buddha, nothing else. And please forgive my bad Chinese pronunciations. It's transliterated into Roman letters, so I'll do the best I can along the way. The patriarch said, if you're from Lingnan, you must be a barbarian. How could you become a Buddha? I replied, people may come from the north or come from the south, but fundamentally there is no north or south to the Buddha nature. The body of a barbarian and that of a high master are not the same, but what difference is there in our Buddha nature? The fifth patriarch wished to continue the conversation, but noticing that his disciples were gathering all around, he told me to follow the group off to work. I said, Huineng wants to inform the High Master that wisdom is always active in this disciple's mind, as I never depart from my essential nature. This itself is, quote, the field of blessings. What work would the High Master have me do? The fifth patriarch replied, what a barbarian. They obviously have a sense of humour like the Northeast Thai Ajahns as well. What a barbarian. You're very sharp. Say no more. Go to the granary shed in the back and get to work. So, I withdrew to a back building where a labourer put me to work splitting firewood and threshing rice on the hulling pestles. Rice from the rice plants has a husk, a kind of coarse shell around the grain, and so to free the rice grains that can be cooked and eaten, they have to pound them so that the husks, the shell, the kind of covering, comes off. So that's called hulling the rice. I spent more than 8 months at this work when the patriarch unexpectedly came one day to see me and said, I think your insights can be of some use, but I was afraid that bad people would harm you. That's why I haven't spoken to you. Do you understand the situation? I replied, your disciple understands the master's intentions and has avoided the front hall so as not to call attention to myself. One day the patriarch summoned all his disciples and said to them, I tell you, for all the people, the matter of birth and death is a serious concern. Yet, all day long, you just seek good fortune and happiness rather than trying to escape from the bitter sea of birth and death. If you're confused about your essential nature, how can blessings save you? I want all of you to draw upon your wisdom and use the prajna essence of your original mind to compose a verse to show me. If you understand the great meaning, I will pass on to you the robe and the Dharma, making you the sixth patriarch. Go now. This is an urgent issue. Thinking about it is useless. Someone who has experienced the essential nature should see it immediately upon hearing these words. One who perceives like this could see it even in the heat of battle, facing whirling swords. The assembly received his instructions and withdrew, saying to one another, we followers don't need to clear our minds and labour our wits to compose a verse to show the High Master. What's the use? Shen Xiu is our senior instructor. Certainly he will get it. The vice abbot, the next senior monk down from the patriarch, had the name Shen Xiu. Certainly he will get it. It would not only be an affront to him, like an insult to him, but a waste of effort for us to compose a verse. Others hearing this all put their minds to rest, saying, from now on we will rely on Master Shen Xiu. Why worry ourselves composing verses? So then Shen Xiu thought, the others are not submitting verses because I'm their senior teacher. I must compose a verse to submit to the High Master. If I don't present a verse, how will the Master know the depth or shallowness of my insight and understanding? If my intention in submitting a verse is to seek for the Dharma, that's good. But if I covet the title of patriarch, that's bad. How would that be any different from any ordinary person presuming to be a sage? But if I don't submit a verse, I will never get the Dharma. What a problem! What a problem! In the front of the fifth patriarch's hall, there was a corridor, 3 rooms long, whose wall was to be frescoed by the court artist, Lu Zhen, with stories from the Lankavatara Sutra, and a diagram of the lineage succession of the 5 patriarchs. So that they might be venerated by future generations. After composing his verse, Shen Xiu made several attempts to submit it, but whenever he reached the front hall, his mind was dazed and he broke out in a sweat. He made 13 attempts over the course of 4 days, all unsuccessful. He's sort of written it down on a scroll and was, not sure, and going back and 13 times over, he was tempted to offer his verse on a scroll and couldn't summon up the courage to do it. Then he thought, it would be better just to write it on the wall so that the High Master might see it. If he says it's good, I'll come forward and bow to him and say, Zhu did it. If instead he finds it unacceptable, then it means I'll have spent my years on this mountain in vain, receiving veneration from others. Where would I go from there? That night, in the third watch, around midnight, so that no one would know, holding a candle, he wrote his verse on the wall of the south corridor that would reveal his insight. The verse read, the body is a Bodhi tree, the mind is a mirror stand bright. Time and again brush it clean, let no dust alight. The body is a Bodhi tree, the mind is like a bright mirror stand, so like a stand on which a bright mirror is placed. Time and again brush it clean and let no dust alight, don't let any dust land on it. After writing this verse, Shen Xiu returned to his room without anyone knowing what he'd done. Then he thought, if the fifth patriarch sees my verse tomorrow and is pleased, it'll mean that I have an affinity with the Dharma. If he finds it unworthy, it'll mean I'm deluded, that karmic obstacles piled up from the past make me unfit to attain the Dharma. It is difficult to fathom a sage's intentions. He remained in his room, thinking it over, but could not sit or sleep peacefully for the rest of the night, right through until dawn. Now, the patriarch knew that Shen Zhu had not yet, quote, entered the gate, unquote, and seen his own essential nature. At daybreak, the patriarch summoned the court artist, Lu Zhen, to fresco the wall of the south corridor. Suddenly, seeing the verse, he said to the artist, there is no need to paint anything. I'm sorry we troubled you to come so far, but as the Diamond Sutra says, all forms are false and illusory. Instead, leave this verse for people to recall and uphold. Whoever cultivates in accord with this verse will not fall into the evil destinies and will obtain great benefit. He then instructed his disciples to light incense and bow before the verse and to recite it so that they might see their essential nature. The disciples all recited it and exclaimed, "Excellent!" At the third watch, around midnight, the patriarch called Shen Zhu into the hall and asked him, "Did you write this verse?" Shen Zhu answered, "Yes, Zhu did it, but I dare not lay claim to the position of patriarch. I only hope the High Master will be compassionate and see whether this disciple has any wisdom or not." The patriarch said, "Your verse shows that you have not yet seen your original nature." And the footnote on this says, Chinese uses, and again, forgive my bad pronunciation, Zijing or Benjing, Zhenjing, and just Jing, interchangeably to mean the same thing. In a similar fashion, English uses inherent nature, essential nature, original nature, fundamental nature, or just nature, depending on the context. You're still outside the gate and have yet to pass through it. With the views and understanding that you have, you may seek for unsurpassed Bodhi, but you will not attain it. Unsurpassed Bodhi means that right at the moment of speaking, you're able to recognize your original mind and see your own fundamental nature is unborn and undying. Unsurpassed Bodhi means you yourself see this naturally, at all times and in every instance of thought, that the myriad dharmas are of a piece, identical. And again, the footnote on this is, the Chinese reads something like, "Wan fa wu ji," is a reference to the mind and its myriad objects as being one and the same. The myriad dharmas are mind-made, or interactive with the mind, basically affirming non-duality of the mind and the reality it creates. And that what is true of one is true of all. The myriad phenomena are naturally thus, as they are. And a mind that is this way accordingly is the true reality. To see in this way is the essence of supreme Bodhi. Go and think this over for a day or two. Then compose another verse, bring it to me. If you have entered the gate, quote unquote, I will entrust you with the Dharma, robe and bowl. Shen Zhu bowed and left. Several days passed, but he was unable to compose a verse. His mind was in a daze, his spirit disturbed, and his mood anxious, as if he were in a dream. Whether walking or sitting down, he was miserable. 2 days later, a young acolyte, one of the students, passed by the threshing room while chanting Shen Zhu's verse. Hearing it for the first time, I knew that the author, this is Huineng speaking, I knew that the author had not yet seen his original nature. Although I had not yet received any formal teaching in the Dharma, I already understood its profound meaning. I asked the boy, "What is that verse you're reciting?" "Barbarian, you know nothing," snapped the boy. "Don't you know that the great master has said that birth and death are the most urgent concern of all people? He wants to pass on the robe and the Dharma, so he told his disciples to write verses and bring them to him for review. If anyone shows he has awakened to the profound meaning, he will inherit the robe and Dharma and become the sixth patriarch. Our senior, Shen Zhu, wrote this unconditioned verse on the wall of the south corridor. The great master ordered everyone to recite it, because whoever cultivates in accord with this verse can avoid falling into evil destinies and gain immense benefit." I said, this is Huineng speaking, "I too would like to recite it to create conditions for a favorable rebirth. Venerable one, I've been pounding rice here for over 8 months and have yet to visit the front hall. Would you please lead me to the verse so I can pay homage to it?" The boy then led me to the verse to bow. I said, "Huineng cannot read. Please, venerable one, read it to me." An administrator of Jiang province, a man called Zhang Ryong, happened to be there at the same time, and he read the verse aloud. After hearing it, I said, "I too have a verse. Will the official please write it down for me?" The administrator replied, "You too? You can compose verses? How unusual." I replied to the official, If you wish to study the unsurpassed Bodhi, do not slight a beginner. The lowest of the low may possess the highest wisdom, and the highest of the high may have the least wisdom. If you slight others, you create limitless, boundless offences. The official then said, recite your verse, and I will write it out for you. If you gain the Dharma, you must liberate me first. Remember this. Don't forget what I say. And my verse, this is the verse of Huineng. Basically, Bodhi has no tree, nor any mirror stand bright. Originally, there is not one thing. Where could the dust alight? After this verse was written down, everyone was startled, amazed. They all said to one another, how strange! You cannot judge a person by his appearance. How can it be that in such a short time one could become a living bodhisattva? The fifth patriarch, seeing everyone so excited, was worried that someone might harm me. He erased the verse with his sandal, so he took his shoe off and kind of scrubbed it out, and saying, there, this one too has not yet seen his nature. The whole community accepted this. The following day, however, the fifth patriarch came unannounced to the threshing floor, like back in the kitchen, where he was pounding the rice, where I was pounding the rice with a stone tied to my waist for added weight. He said, a seeker of the way would forget his very life for the Dharma. Isn't that so? Then he asked me, is the rice ready yet? I answered, the rice has long been ready. It's only waiting now for the sieve, the thing to separate the rice from the husks. The patriarch then struck his staff on the pestle 3 times and left. I immediately knew his intention, pounding the ground 3 times, said, okay, come at the third watch, was his, apparently his secret message. I immediately knew his intention, and at the third watch entered the patriarch's room. Using his robe as a screen so that no one could see us, he explained the Diamond Sutra for me. And when he came to the line in the text, let your mind be unattached, clinging to nothing. As soon as these words were uttered, I experienced a profound awakening and understood that the inherent nature embraces the 10,000 things. And in the Chinese, that line is, again, forgive my bad pronunciation, Ying Wu Suo Zhu Er Sheng Ki Jin. In the Platform Sutra, non-dwelling and non-attachment, or not grasping, clinging, overlap and are used interchangeably, along with Wu Nian and Wu Jin, which literally mean no thought and no mind. All are different ways of expressing the same notion. Master Xuanhua, in his commentary to the Diamond Sutra, says, to have no dwelling is to have no attachment. No attachment is liberation. Therefore, not dwelling, one is liberated, independent, and not blocked or obstructed by anything. So then Huineng says to the patriarch, as soon as these words are uttered, I experienced a profound awakening and understood that the inherent nature embraces the 10,000 things. I said to the patriarch, how unexpected! The essential nature is intrinsically pure. How unexpected! The essential nature is originally unborn and undying. How unexpected! The essential nature is complete in itself. Lacking nothing? How unexpected! The essential nature is fundamentally still and unmoving. How unexpected! From the essential nature, the myriad dharmas come to be. The patriarch realized that I had awakened to the essential nature and said to me, to study the Dharma without recognizing your original mind is useless. If you recognize your original mind and see your essential nature, you can be called a great hero, a teacher of gods and humans, a Buddha. I received the Dharma in the middle of the night and no one knew. At the same time, the master also entrusted me with the direct teaching and gave me the robe and bowl, saying, you are the sixth patriarch. Be careful. Take across living beings everywhere. Spread the teaching for future generations. Don't let it be cut off. I have a verse for you. Out of caring, I am planting this seed. Because of the ground, the fruits will ripen again. Without this feeling, there'd be no seed planted. Without the nature, there'd be no new life to thrive. The patriarch further said, long ago, when the great master Bodhidharma came to this land, people did not believe in him. As a symbol of his sincerity, he bequeathed this robe to be passed along from generation to generation. The Dharma is handed down mind to mind, leading all to their own awakening and their own liberation. From ancient times, all Buddhas only transmit the fundamental truth. The true intention is passed along more privately from master to master. The robe, however, has become a source of contention. Let it stop with you and not be passed on. For if you pass it on, your life will be hanging by a thread. Quickly, go now, for I fear others might harm you. I asked, where should I go? The patriarch replied, stop at Hui and hide at Hui. So I'll leave that there. I feel there's many, many parallels with Lumpur Cha's expression of things, particularly his teachings about non-abiding. And also, to me, it's very, very interesting passing on the line from the Diamond Sutra, don't cling to anything. And that brings to mind the parallel from what's called the Lesser Discourse on the Destruction of Craving. Tanha Sankhaya Sutra, thank you. Where the Buddha says the Pali phrase, Sabbe Dhamma Nalang Abhinivesaya. And he says, if you've heard that, you've heard everything. If you've practiced that, you've practiced everything. If you've realized the truth of that, you've realized everything. If you've brought that to fulfillment, then you have fulfilled all the attributes of the path. You've finished the practice. It's just a four-word phrase, and Ajahn Buddhadasa would say, this is summarizing the whole Buddha Dharma in four words. Sabbe Dhamma Nalang Abhinivesaya. What it means is, nothing whatsoever should be clung to. Don't cling to anything. I'm not sure about the Chinese, but in essence is the same as that essential teaching that is there in the Chula Tanha Sankhaya Sutta, the shorter discourse on the destruction of craving, which is, I think, 37 sutta in the Majjhima?
My name. You've got a far better memory for stuff like that.
Yes. Anyway, I feel that the verse that Hui Neng wrote, whereas the one written by the second monk, Shen Xiu, was talking about a worldly method of cleansing the mind and appropriately wiping the dust from the mirror, being a way of describing living skillfully, training the mind in wholesome activities and developing wholesome dhammas like concentration, developing a sila, developing generosity, compassion, and these wholesome qualities. But they are conditioned and worldly qualities. The young Hui Neng takes it to a whole different level and says, well, in terms of wisdom, from the Dhamma side of it, there really isn't anywhere for the dust to land. In the quality of genuine wisdom, like the Anidasana Vijnana, that unsupportive consciousness, that's the mind which doesn't support anything, the mind which is not supported by anything, that quality of awakened awareness, that is really the embodiment of Dhamma, and it's reflecting that quality of clear, unequivocal wisdom. Also, the languaging of original mind, you do find that within the forest tradition, and the term in Thai language, Chit Dham, literally translates as original mind. It comes up in various different teachings of forest Ajahns. Lumpur Cha used that phrase, and I think Lumpur Mun's teachings also, you find it. Various different Ajahns would use that. In the dialogue with some Western monks, you find in Lumpur Cha's collected teachings, I think Ajahn Jagaro is asking Lumpur Cha, what's the original mind? It's a very interesting dialogue to read and reflect upon, because the conceiving nature, or the conceptualizing nature of the Western monk asking the questions, Lumpur Cha can see he's trying to pin it down in terms of an idea or a thought. He's sort of trying to understand what original mind is, but being lost in thought as he's asking the question, as I read the text. Is the original mind outside the five khandhas? Is there anything left that remains outside the five khandhas? And then Lumpur Cha says something like, if there's anything left, you should throw it to the dogs. So don't think of original mind as a thing that's separate from the five khandhas and the world of other things. But you're conceiving too much, you're getting lost in that thinking and conceptualizing. Were you there when... No, you were already away.
That was a Gornok. That was my Pansa Dauda.
So any questions, thoughts, reflections on all of that? Yes. It's called the Sixth Patriarch's Dharma Jewel Platform Sutra, translated by the community of City of 10,000 Buddhas, Dharma Realm Buddhist University, the disciples of Master Xuanhua. Master Hua was the one who gave half of the land of Abhayagiri Monastery. So Abhayagiri exists where it does because of his gift of 120 acres of land. And so we had a good friendship with them. It's only about 20 miles away, just south of Ukiah. 16 miles away, there you go. It's fairly close by. I have a fairly steady, friendly exchanges between our monasteries. They visit us, we visit them for different events. also known as the Platform Sutra.
Yeah, there's many translations of it.
Different people have done translations of it over the years. The story of Huineng's life is quite dramatic. After that, because he was, quote-unquote, a barbarian from the south and illiterate then, people were upset that he'd been named as the successor of the fifth patriarch, and so he went off and lived in hiding for about 16 years after that time. To maintain his safety, he lived with a group of hunters in the forest. He just lived on vegetables and leaves and roots. He didn't eat any of the animals that the hunters were catching, but it was kind of a safe environment for him to stay in for 16 years. And then after that time, then he poked his nose out and he came along to a Dharma assembly and then joined in with the Dharma dialogues, and people realized, oh, this scruffy guy from the forest has got something to it. And then he was able to take up that role and received ordination. He was still a layman up to that point. Then received the ordination and was recognized as the fifth patriarch. But then after that time, there had been that custom from Bodhidharma passing on the robe and the arms fold. Seemingly that stopped with Huineng.
And then it's mentioned the Heart Sutra?
The Vajra Sutra. The Diamond Sutra. Again, there's many, many translations of that.
Is the Pali canon?
No, there's parallels. There's certain parts of the Vajra Sutra that are closely paralleled in the Pali canon, but it's not exactly the same. Or the Vajra Prajna Paramita Sutra, like the sutra on the indestructible paramita or virtue of wisdom. Many, many translations. Yes?
John, is there a difference between Jittam and Puru?
Yes and no. If you're talking about fundamental nature of mind, and it would depend on the context. And Thai is wonderfully loose, which is great, because it's the point of, in English language, you're always trying to objectify something, and you end up getting tangled up in it. Whereas if you've got a little bit looser, then you can get a feel for it.
I wasn't there, and I wouldn't want to second-guess Lumpur Cha, even though I frequently do. I think that's why he said, if there's anything left, just throw it to the dogs. It's like you're making an idea out of that which isn't an idea. One way of looking at it is the puru, the patru, the element of awareness, is a function of citta. So loosely using the language, you could say Dhamma is the fundamental substance or quality, and then the Buddha is the function, or the awareness is a function. So that awakened aware quality is a function of that fundamental nature. Again, using the language very loosely, and Abhidharma scholars are probably spinning in their funeral urns.
In their little cremation rooms.
That would be a way that I would configure that in my own thinking. This is one of my favorite Dharma books, I fully confess. Nyanamoli's Life of the Buddha and the Sixth Patriarch Sutra are my two favorite Dharma books. So, apart from the island, of course. No, I said, I like this one more than this one. So to continue then, I can repeat some of the story, but since it's here in the book, I'll repeat it anyway. The most obvious candidate for the inheritance was the senior instructor and preceptor, Shen Qiu. The others of the thousand-strong assembly hesitated to compose verses because they all thought that Shen Qiu would be the one to receive the mantle, the acknowledgement. He, however, had major doubts about his own accomplishments and so wrote his verse covertly in the middle of the night on a wall of the corridor, which was being decorated with some murals. When, to his relieved amazement, the fifth patriarch praised it, he revealed himself as the author, and that verse ran, "The body is a Bodhi tree, the mind is like a bright mirror stand. Time and again brush it clean and let no dust alight." As he was illiterate, as Huineng was illiterate, and could not read it himself, it was not until he heard another of the residents reciting this verse to himself that Huineng found out about what Shen Qiu had written. Once he'd heard it, he persuaded an official, who was also staying at the monastery, to transcribe for him a markless verse in response, like a markless meaning kind of empty of self and other. "Originally, Bodhi has no tree. The bright mirror has no stand. Originally, there is not a single thing. Where can dust alight?" Suffice to say that, on the strength of this, Huineng became the sixth patriarch, even though he had to live in hiding with hunters in a remote forest for 16 years to avoid the jealous machinations of factions who objected to an illiterate barbarian, quote-unquote, from the south being given the great honour. Eventually he came forth, received ordination, and became the greatest of China's Buddhist masters. This sutra has the honour of being the only one in the Chinese canon that overtly comes from a time after the Lord Buddha. I won't bore you with much more of the story, but one of the famous koans that they use in China and in Japan, I think maybe Korea as well, I'm not sure, is the question, show me your original face before your mother and father were born. That statement, apparently, according to the story, comes while Huineng was fleeing. The group of people from the monastery were chasing after him, and one particularly athletic member of the pursuing group was a soldier. He was very, very fit and ran very quickly, and so Huineng couldn't get away. He realized this soldier's going to catch up with me. And so he put the robe and bowl on a rock beside the path and then took himself off to one side and hid. And then the soldier came along and saw the robe and the bowl sitting there on the rock. But when he tried to pick it up, he couldn't lift them. They didn't weigh very much, but he wasn't able to lift them off the rock. And then when Huineng appeared, then what he said to the soldier was, as I remember the story, show me your original face before your mother and father were born, and then you can take the bowl and the robe. And then the soldier realized, I think I should leave this guy alone. This is obviously not normal. The fact I can't lift up this piece of cloth and this little alms bowl, and he's asking me this mysterious question. I think he should be left alone. And so then he bowed to the young Huineng and took his way back down the path and told him, he's not that way, let's try over here. And he kind of led the rest of the pursuing group off in a different direction. Huineng was able to make his escape. Yes.
Do you know why 16 years? Why he came back after 16 years?
You have to read the story. I think it was just sort of letting things die down. I'm not sure. He was often hiding in the forest. One can only guess, maybe thought, well, maybe enough time's gone by, let's sort of go along to a monastery, to a Dhamma assembly, listen to what people are saying and catch some of the conversation that people have, or they're talking about the state of the teachings or the religion, or just testing the waters. I have no memory of being there at the time. I think it's simply having let a good amount of time pass by and thinking, okay, this might be the moment to appear, and then he made that choice. It was also that, and Lumpur Cha used to quote this, because Ajahn Buddhadasa was quite active in translating some Zen teachings into Thai, and the teachings of Huang Po, and I think he also translated at least some of this.
Yeah.
And there was an American Zen practitioner who stayed at Suan Mok. Apparently Ajahn Buddhadasa had really enjoyed having conversations with and learnt a lot about Zen from him. So you have Lumpur Cha quoting some of that in one or two of his Dhamma talks, because the assembly that Huineng went to, there was two monks that were debating about a flag moving in the wind. And one is saying, it's the flag that's moving. The other one is saying, no, it's the wind that's moving. And there was this sort of philosophical debate going on between the two. And according to the story, Huineng piped up and said, Venerable Sirs, it is neither the flag or the wind that is moving. It is your minds that are moving. And I went, oh, who's this guy? So the attention went to him, and then he stepped up and acknowledged that he had this background. And so Lumpur Cha would quote that and say, this Huineng had a lot of wisdom, that it was not the flag or the wind, it's the people's minds moving. So that was the moment of emergence. That's as much as I know about the story. So any further questions on that? That's the end of that long chapter on unsupported and unsupportive consciousness. Okay, the next chapter, chapter 9, is called The Unconditioned and Non-Locality. With some comprehension of unsupported and unsupportive consciousness, as well as the quality of atamayata, which you'll probably recall means not made of thatness, we begin to say goodbye to the world of geography, since, just as there was no where, quote-unquote, for the sunlight to land in the Buddha's compelling simile, in that last chapter. The consciousness of Nibbana, although real, is best described as being unlocated. It's interesting to reflect that only what we call physical existence, i.e. rupakanda, is at all dependent on three-dimensional space. All the factors of the mental realm, the namakandas, are unlocated, quote-unquote. That is to say, the concepts of place and space do not, in any true sense, apply there. So you can't say the mind is anywhere. Awareness does not apply in the realm of the namakandas. Our thoughts and perceptions are so geared to operate in terms of three-dimensional space as the basic reality, and that view of things seems so obvious to common sense that it's hard for us to conceive of any other possibility. It's only through meditative insight that we can develop the uncommon sense required to see things differently. A couple of everyday examples might serve to lead us into the subject. Before going on to those, any thoughts or questions on that so far? Non-locality has... The word is used in various different ways in particle physics as well as in Buddha Dharma. Referring to that quality of conditioning that the mind has to think in terms of this place, that place, here and there, and the conditioning of the senses, and how, in terms of ultimate reality, location, place, doesn't really apply. So that non-localities seem to be a good way to represent that. Okay, so the two examples. Firstly, the word cyberspace is used more and more frequently these days. One talks of, quote, visiting such and such a website, or my email address. But where are these? Abhayagiri Monastery has a website, but it does not exist anywhere. It has no geographical location. The words visit, home page, address, and such like are the easy jargon of Siberia, spelled C-Y-B-E-R-I-A. And we can be very comfortable using such terms, but the fact is that just like a thought, and indeed the mind itself, although they exist, they cannot be said to truly be anywhere. Three-dimensional space does not apply in their context. A second example comes from a purportedly true incident. An American tourist in Oxford, England, approached a tweed-jacketed and bespectacled professorial type and said, "Excuse me, I wonder if you can tell me where exactly is the university?" Like London University, which I attended, there is no campus. There's separate colleges dotted all around Oxford, for Oxford University, or London, and in fact 44 colleges dotted all over London. But there is no place which is London University. Similarly with Oxford, Cambridge, other universities that don't have a campus. So that's what this incident is based upon. So this bespectacled professorial type, probably with a pipe in his pocket. "Madam," the professorial type responded, "the university is not in reality anywhere. The university possesses only metaphysical rather than actual existence." That means the university, being comprised of separate independent colleges and not having a campus, is just a concept agreed upon by a number of humans to have some validity. It might have financial dealings, it might set exams and issue degrees, but physically, it does not exist. There are the different colleges that one might attend or visit, but, quote, the university, unquote, no. Like a website or a virtual garden in a computer program, or indeed, like a mythical country such as Erewhon. That was a Victorian novel. Erewhon is nowhere spelled backwards. The mythical country of Erewhon. All can be said to exist, but awareness does not apply. They are unlocated. As we cross the border into the realm of the unconditioned, if such a metaphor is valid, there needs to be a relinquishing of such habitual concepts as self and time and place. The apprehension of ultimate truth, the paramata satya, necessarily involves a radical letting go of all these familiar structures. I found this a very fruitful area of reflection. A few readings ago, I was talking about that it was many, many years I was practicing meditation, been living as a Buddhist monk, before I even realized that the mind was so conditioned to that sense of locatedness, of here-ness, And it was in one of the early retreats at Abhayagiri. In the first 3 or 4 years that we were there, had very few visitors. It's quite remote. Mendocino County, where it's situated, has a very small human population, about 100,000 people in 3 million acres. The big town of Ukiah has a population of 50.
It has that many people.
Yeah, the biggest town in Mendocino County has 15,000 people. Berkhamsted has about 35 or 40,000. So that's the county.
It's called a village.
So Ukiah, and the next biggest town, Willits, is about 5,000 people. And about 2.5 hours drive, 3 hours drive north of San Francisco and Berkeley. Very few visitors. So the winter retreats were very rainy and very quiet. So there's a lot of time for solitary practice and extremely sort of still, quiet. Our winter retreat support team would be about 6 people, if that. Not that any of you are extra. This is a much bigger place. So it was very small, very quiet. About 3 weeks into the winter retreat this year, about the third or fourth year we were there, it'd be about 2000, 2001, there was a lot of opportunity for formal practice and my mind was very, very quiet. Everything was very quiet, very still. But I began to notice that even though there was the usual working to develop and cultivate the insights into anicca, dukkha, anatta, and all of that seemed to be quite clear and straightforward, there was this, somehow this stressing in the system. There was a feeling of burdenness or stressing or tension in the system. And I thought, what is this? Because looking at those feelings of I and me and mine, it all seemed to be quite spacious and nothing sort of forming around an I, me, or mine feeling, and no sort of habitual grasping or clinging around that. But there was definitely this kind of tightness, this tension, stressing in the system. And so this was really puzzling. I kind of looking at this for 3 or 4 days, like, this is kind of weird. Everything else is really quiet, really peaceful. What is this stress in the system? It doesn't seem to be any kind of a me here. Oh, here. There's a here. And it was like bing. I mean, not quite a sort of literal bell going off, but it was like, oh my goodness. You know, I've been a monk for, I don't know, 20 years or so by then. But it hadn't ever occurred to me, oh right, that sense of here-ness, a knower that's in a physical space with a front, back, up, down, that's a quality of grasping, that's a quality of clinging, attachment. Wow. So I simultaneously felt very stupid that I'd missed it. It never occurred to me in my mind to notice that. So I felt simultaneously relieved and very stupid. How could I have missed that? That became really like a rich area to explore, how strong and subtle that kind of conditioning was, that the sense of a, even if there's not any kind of definable me who's the experiencer, the experience is happening here. There's a locatedness. And so that is one of the themes of this chapter, that non-locality, the unlocated nature of Dhamma and the fundamental unlocated nature of mind and knowing. And just to read one more little bit, just to illustrate that, the stories of Lungtan Mahabua from his book called Straight from the Heart. Here is a present-day example, and to illustrate the centrality of such relinquishment is the insight which arose for Ajahn Mahabua in the period of intense practice immediately following Ajahn Mun's final passing away. It was this thought which he describes as having arisen on its own, and more that it was heard rather than thought, which led to Ajahn Mahabua's full enlightenment shortly thereafter. And this is Ajahn Tanisaro's translation in the book Straight from the Heart. If there is a point or a center of the knower anywhere, that is the essence of a level of being. If there is a point or a center of the knower anywhere, that is the essence of a level of being. So again, I'd read those words before, and then you read them, oh yeah, right. But it wasn't until that rainy, very quiet retreat time at the Abhayagiri that kind of principle really came alive and had profound meaning, and there was a felt sense of that. Any comments, thoughts on that domain, Ajahn?
It's just beautiful to recollect that in reality. Just as the Ajahn Mahabua was, because being or becoming is immediately gravitating to somewhere, something, somehow, someplace, something, some anything.
I don't know what the Pali for awareness would be, but it's probably the sort of thing I would ask Ajahn Vinitha. He'd go, search through his memory banks and his dictionaries, and he'd find a reference to it. So, any questions, thoughts, comments? Yes.
One of the descriptions of the Dharma is kind of here and now. So, have you had an equivalent kind of insight into nowness as a hereness?
Well, anicca. It's like things are not really anicca because things are not really things. There isn't really anything that's changing. Just out of our conventions of speech and perception, we say, this book is changing, the cover is wearing out. The words are changing, the sounds are changing. But in terms of nowness or timelessness, the akaliko dhamma, we reflect on anicca, impermanence, and that reflection leads to the realization, oh, there isn't really anything that's ever born and dying, that ever really begins and ends. We just talk about the world of things in that way for the sake of communication and functioning in the conditioned realm. But there isn't really anything. In this sutra, there's a section later on in the sutra where it says, in this moment, there is no thing that comes to be. In this moment, there is no thing that ceases to be. Thus, in this moment, there is no birth and death to be brought to an end. Therefore, this moment is the absolute peace. And though it is just this moment, there is no limit to this moment. And herein is eternal delight. It's a great book. Simply taking a phrase like, in this moment, there is no thing that comes to be. Or like contemplating locationness or hereness, just a word like now, or where is here? Or just that little quotation, in this moment, there is no thing that comes to be. And then just letting the impact of those words have its own effect. And even if it's just for a moment, a second, then that rejigs the habits of perception, at least in this mind. So it creates a different baseline, again, if such language can apply, for experience. So that now is not just a very, very short period of time. It's referring to a whole different quality. Speaking of time, the hour has gone by, so let's call things to a close now.